Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. So today, we're undertaking a deep dive into the fascinating world of Henry James. His work, especially the material we're looking at, really paints him as this colossal figure. He essentially bridges that formal 19th century realism, you know, Dickens, Eliot,
right,
with the more psychological, inward-looking complexities that you get in 20th century modernism. And when you start reading James, you immediately hit his lifelong obsession,
yeah,
the international theme.
Ah, yes, that famous cultural collision. And it's really the core engine, isn't it, for so many of his novels. You've got the Americans, often innocent, full of this boundless idealism, sometimes quite wealthy.
Often quite wealthy, yeah.
Venturing into Europe. And that world is, well, ancient, deeply sophisticated, tangled up in traditions, and often pretty cynical. And if you really want the definitive look at this collision, you go straight to The Portrait of a Lady, published back in 1881.
Absolutely. And we're calling this deep dive The Gilded Cage, because the novel is fundamentally a tragic exploration. It looks at how even the most noble intentions in this specific case, granting absolute freedom, can somehow lead to, well, disastrous consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So our core mission here is really to understand the tragedy of Isabel Archer. What actually happens when someone who values her liberty, her potential, above everything else, is suddenly given the financial power to do anything.
It's such an intoxicating setup. We first meet our young American protagonist, Isabel Archer, at Garden Court. It's a beautiful, tranquil English estate, and she's immediately captivating. She's spirited, fiercely intelligent, and just filled with this romantic, almost bookish idealism about what life should be.
Yeah.
And she views her personal freedom as sacred.
Yeah.
It's the single greatest thing she possesses.
And her actions show this right away, don't they? She gets presented with two, you know, exceptionally eligible suitors almost immediately, both representing very different paths. First, there's Lord Warburton. He's the kind, steady English nobleman offering security, status, comfort. Then there's Caspar Goodwood, the intense, passionate American industrialist offering this love that's almost overwhelming.
Yeah, forceful.
Forceful, exactly.
Yeah.
Yet she turns them both down.
She does, because she sees both paths as a kind of premature closure. Like marriage to either man would be a pre-written ending to her story. She feels she hasn't lived enough or seen enough or maybe even suffered enough to commit yet.
Right.
She famously tells Warburton, "I don't want to begin life by marrying. There are other things a woman can do."
Yeah.
She really wants to choose her own fate, not just accept one offered by society or even by passion.
Okay, let's pause on that, though, because our sources really highlight her cousin, Ralph Touchett, as crucial here. Ralph's confined by this fatal lung illness, and he watches Isabel with this almost artistic fascination. He's obsessed with her potential.
He absolutely is.
And he convinces his dying father to leave Isabel this colossal fortune.
Ralph's motivation is, it's complicated. It's a profound but platonic love. He sees her as this magnificent sort of unformed work of art, and he wants to give her the financial means, the scaffolding, as he sees it, to meet the requirements of her imagination. He truly believes he's giving her the ultimate tool for freedom.
But, you know, is that really noble, or is it maybe profoundly, if well-meaningly, arrogant? He's essentially meddling in the life of someone he cares about, placing this huge destabilizing weight of money on her just to satisfy his own curiosity about what she might become. It's almost like an experiment, and she's the subject.
And tragically, that wealth becomes the very thing that pulls her away from the, you know, the protective sunlight of Garden Court and into the polished but much more dangerous world of continental Europe. The setting shifts dramatically to Florence.
Right.
And there, Isabel, now this great heiress, is just perfectly positioned for exploitation by people who see her wealth as, well, a resource to be harvested.
And this is where we meet the antagonists, these masters of the facade. Madame Merle, the brilliant, oh-so-smooth expatriate American, and Gilbert Osmond, the sterile, affected aesthete and art collector.
Madame Merle is really the architect of Isabel's downfall. She positions herself as a friend, a mentor, while secretly setting the trap. She's the one who introduces Isabel to Osmond.
Osmond.
Yeah, a man who cultivates this image of being profoundly superior, like he's above vulgar society, living purely for exquisite taste and art.
So how could someone like Isabel, who valued her independence so fiercely, fall for a man whose whole personality seems built on control and appearance? It seems like such a contradiction.
Well, her idealism really blinds her here. She interprets Osmond's reserve, his lack of conventional ambition, his almost aggressive mediocrity, in a way, as genuine philosophical depth. She actually believes she's making the most independent choice possible by marrying him.
Wow.
She's choosing the unconventional, the supposedly artistic genius, over the more standard offers from Warburton or Goodwood. The irony is just, it's devastating.
And what she gets instead is the novel's subtle but utterly malignant antagonist. Osmond is cold, deeply selfish, and aggressively controlling. Our sources are pretty clear. He sees Isabel not as a partner, not as a wife, but as the ultimate art object to add to his collection.
Exactly.
He wants her money, yes, but maybe even more. He wants to possess her spirit, to dictate her function in his meticulously curated, sterile life. That journey from the openness of Garden Court to the dark, art-filled corridors of Florence and Rome, it perfectly symbolizes her increasing psychological confinement. She literally walks into her own gilded cage.
And the narrative jumps forward several years.
Yeah.
We find Isabel trapped in Rome. Her vibrant, curious spirit has just been slowly, methodically crushed. The freedom she sought so desperately, it's been violently replaced by this stifling psychological prison.
That emotional climax of the novel, the moment of self-confrontation, happens in chapter 42, doesn't it? James is such a master of psychological realism. The real action is all happening inside her head.
Oh, completely. She sits alone, late at night, by the fire, just tracing the path of her colossal mistake. She finally acknowledges this great black, quiet gulf that now exists between what she expected and the grim reality.
It sounds brutal.
It is brutal. She realizes, with horrifying clarity, that Osmond married her only for her money and to possess her, like you said, as a beautiful, pliable ornament. That freedom she was given by Ralph, it simply became the lock on her cage door. That house, as you mentioned, has become a house of suffocation.
Her life might have just continued in that state of quiet misery, but Osmond delivers one final, utterly cruel act of control. He forbids her from traveling to England to see Ralph Touchett, who is dying.
Mm-hmm.
And that command is the catalyst. It forces Isabel's first real act of rebellion against him. It finally pushes her past the point of just passively accepting her fate.
And just as she's preparing to defy him, she gets the final devastating piece of the whole conspiratorial puzzle. It comes from Osmond's sister, the Countess Gemini.
Ah, the Countess.
The Countess reveals that Pansy, the young daughter Isabel has been trying to protect and nurture, is actually the illegitimate child of Osmond and Madame Merle.
Wait, Madame Merle's Pansy's mother all along. That's a level of Machiavellian plotting that is truly monstrous. It makes all their early conversations, Merle's supposed guidance, just feel deliberately cruel in hindsight.
Exactly. The entire marriage was basically a conspiracy, orchestrated by Merle to secure a fortune through Isabel for her own daughter. All those beautiful facades just crumble away, revealing nothing but moral emptiness underneath.
So Isabel defies Osmond. She goes to Garden Court.
Yes, for that heartbreaking final scene with Ralph. He confesses his deep platonic love for her and expresses his profound dying regret that his gift of money, which was born from such seemingly noble intentions, ultimately led to her ruin.
Wow.
And this shared moment of devastating honesty finally provides Isabel with the emotional clarity and perhaps the human solace she so desperately needed.
Okay, so the story ends there, but the analysis, the real deep dive, kind of begins here. James's genius is really in that complex ending, which forces us, the readers, to weigh several intense themes. Let's start with that central tension, freedom versus responsibility.
Right. Isabel learns the hard way that true freedom isn't just the absence of limits or the endless potential of a blank page. It's more about the mature acceptance of consequences, of the duty that follows your choices. She made her choice. Now she has to live with the fallout.
And that theme of appearance versus reality is just everywhere. Osmond and Merle are consummate performers. Isabel's tragedy, her core mistake, stems from her intense, idealistic desire to see beyond the conventional, which ironically blinded her to the truly ugly reality hidden behind Osmond's beautiful facade.
We also can't ignore the critique of the subjugation of women, can we? James shows us that even with absolute financial power, the very thing that was supposed to liberate a woman in the 19th century, the institution of marriage could still be weaponized. Isabel's inheritance didn't free her. It just made her a more valuable commodity to be trapped, possessed, and ultimately diminished.
All of which leads us to that famously ambiguous final climax. After Ralph's death, Caspar Goodwood returns. He passionately urges her to escape with him, sealing his plea with that forceful kiss, which overwhelms her for a moment with the sheer possibility of a clean break.
Mm.
But the very next day, Isabel begins her journey back. Back to Rome, back to Osmond.
And this is the unanswerable moment, isn't it? Is her return an act of self-destruction? Is it an almost masochistic surrender to the cage she herself helped build? Is she just too bruised, too tired to fight anymore?
Or is it the opposite? Is it the ultimate act of a complex moral maturity? Is she accepting her responsibility, not just for her own mistake, but for the collateral damage, particularly her duty to Pansy, who's now left without any other real moral protector? Is she choosing dignity and consequence over escape via passion?
It forces you, the reader, into this deep debate. Is the meaning of life found in successfully escaping a bad choice? Or is it perhaps found in discovering the moral courage, the dignity, to endure the consequences of that choice with your eyes wide open? James just refuses to give us an easy answer, a simple happy ending.
The enduring resonance of this portrait lies precisely in that tension, I think. Its unflinching look at the gap between noble, often abstract, intentions and tragic, painful results. It really holds up a mirror, not just to 19th century society, but maybe to our own modern assumptions about what freedom or even money can truly buy.
Yeah, it remains this timeless meditation on what it actually means to be a free individual within a world that's full of constraints, reminding us that even great wealth doesn't immunize you from human folly or from the cruelty of others.
Think about this. If Henry James were writing this story today and Isabel had inherited, say, infinite cryptocurrency and massive social media influence instead of a trust fund, would the consequences of her choices, that inability to distinguish authentic depth from a beautiful online facade, be any less tragic? We think that remains the final provocative question. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.